Blog Talk Radio.
I truly love your voice, but I have to tell you, you should have said it this morning in Finnish, okay? Today is Finland Day, everybody, okay? Rather than grouse about, you know, the orange man, okay? Let's talk about how fabulous it is that Finland is now officially a member of NATO. Okay, I'm serious, okay? There's something to celebrate today, okay? And that's the thing I'm going to celebrate, okay? So good morning, everyone. This is Jeffrey Swartz. I am a professor of law at Good morning. I haven't gotten to you yet, Hezzy. Okay. Okay. I'm a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus. Okay, I'm here with my compatriot, Brendan Berry, who just by mere coincidence is a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus. Okay, and before I get to Hezzy, because I'm going to make him wait, I have to do this disclaimer. And the disclaimer simply is that everything that Brendan and I say here, our opinions, whatever we say, are our opinions and our opinions alone, except for where we share them, okay, and not necessarily the opinion of the administration and or the faculty of WMU Cooley Law School, its faculty either at large or individually. And first thing I'm going to say is, good morning, Brendan.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Hi, Hez. How you doing? We're here with Hezzy.
Good morning.
This is airtime. I just like to give him a hard time. Hi, Hez. How you doing?
Good morning to both of you. What a pleasure. You put a smile on me this morning.
Well,
Finland Day. I'm going to remember that next year, too.
It's Finland Day. That's right. We're celebrating Finland today, okay? I don't know how to say it in Finnish. I probably should look it up when I got a few minutes during the show. I'm going to look it up. How do you say Happy Finland Day in Finnish, okay? And, okay, because I think it's terrific, 900 more miles of NATO borders on Russia. See what a great job you did there, Vladimir, by intimidating NATO. You did a great job, okay? All you did was intimidate the people you shouldn't have intimidated into joining NATO. Congratulations. And hopefully Sweden will follow very shortly once Erdogan gets his pound of flesh. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So, this morning is a momentous day. For some, it is Donald Trump is a defendant day. For some, it's Donald Trump is a defendant day, and we have to fight back. Okay. For those of us who look at it the way it should be looked at, this is neither a happy nor a sad day. This is just another day where we're going to exhibit that due process and the justice system applies to everyone. And that includes Donald Trump, former president of the United States. God, it's hard to admit that that's so, but he is. And I think we have to think about it in those terms. In that regard, Brendan and I talked yesterday and came out with about two pages of questions that we think need to be answered.
Mm-hmm.
Some of which we won't have answers to, we can only project, some of which we will talk about in particular. And so there is one thing that I want to talk about news-wise. Yeah. Apparently, Donald gave an interview to Hannity over the weekend.
Yeah.
You know where I'm going with this, Brendan? Okay.
I do. I was going to bring it up if you didn't. Yeah.
Well, you know what? You know what? You go ahead and bring it up. You go ahead.
Well, no, it's Hannity was, well, it reminded me, you know the scene from A Few Good Men?
You can't handle the truth.
Yeah, right. But the line I have in mind is, did you order the code red? You're damn right I did. Right? just got a confession out of him, right? Right there on the spot. The same kind of thing happened with...
He didn't mean to do it. Hannity did not mean to do that.
That's the difference. See, the Tom Cruise character, whatever his name is, he meant to elicit a confession, right? Hannity was trying not to. But But nonetheless, he got a you're damn right I did out of Donald Trump without trying. Hannity says, I can't picture you, you know, rooting through boxes, you know, ordering people to bring boxes from the White House. You wouldn't do that. And Trump basically said, you're damn right I did. Not in so many words.
I have every
right
to do it.
Yeah, right.
I could.
Yeah.
Okay, would. Okay.
Yeah, right. That's.
I mean, it was absurd. Here's Kennedy, okay? And you see, you start out there. He says, you know, there's allegations. I mean, I can't see you, okay, if you want a softball question. I can't see you telling people to bring you boxes and going through the boxes and looking at the documents. And the response was, well, you know, I could. And I have the right to do that. The Presidential Records Act says that I have the right to do that. Nixon got paid $18 million for his presidential records. Well, you know, I know that history and timelines don't mean anything to Donald, but the Presidential Records Act wasn't passed till 1979. And do we know why they passed the Presidential Records Act? Because Nixon took all of his records and they had to pay him to get them back. So they passed this law that says those documents don't belong to the president. They belong to the government. He says, well, I'm entitled to take stuff. No, you're not. The presidential, you don't know how to read, Donald. You should learn how to read, okay? And don't say what a statute says when you've never read the friggin' statute. I mean, he literally confessed. I mean, if you're Jack Smith, you've got this big – I mean, you're taking clips. I can just see it now. Donald takes the stand in an indictment for obstruction of justice and all the things that go with it for Mar-a-Lago. And Jack Smith gets him under cross-examination and says, video 35. And they bring up the Hannity thing. Dirt, is that you? Is that Hannity? And is that your voice, and did you say those things? But yet here today you're saying you didn't do anything on purpose, and you didn't look at the records, and you didn't handle the boxes. Okay, bring up 36. This is a video from your office, sir. Is that you? Are those boxes full of government documents? Is that you looking at them and going through them? But you're still saying you didn't do that. Do you have any idea how many – his cross-examination to take a week of just showing clips of how he's lying. I wouldn't represent him in that case if he offered me the entirety of his fortune, which he wouldn't, but, you know, because he doesn't pay his bills anyway. But I wouldn't represent him. That is going to be the quickest guilty verdict in the history of the federal court. 12 people instantaneously saying, who votes guilty? And every hand goes up. Okay, let the judge know we have a verdict. Okay. You know, we're not even going to wait until the lunch. We'll take it to go. Okay? Like sometimes they wait until after lunch to make it look good. Okay, just box it up for me. Okay? Okay, it's like going to dinner with Marilyn. Good morning, Marilyn. Going to dinner with Marilyn, who always takes food home in a box, okay? She always takes food home, okay? She just boxed it up for me, okay? Oh, God. Okay. I'm glad we brought that up. I really am. I think that was a great way for me to start the day. Okay. Talk about walls caving in. Okay. Got a lot of questions.
I have to correct something I said last time we were on.
What was that?
I was thinking about it, you know, and this related to the Hannity Trump thing. But when last we were on, I said, you know, Trump's likely to set a record that will stand as being the only former president to be indicted on three different criminal enterprises in three different jurisdictions. But I undercounted there. It's actually four, because Jack Smith is going after not only the documents case in Mar-a-Lago, but also the insurrection in D.C. So that's actually, although Jack Smith is one prosecutor, I amend my statement to predict that Donald Trump will be the first former president to be indicted on four separate criminal enterprises in four separate jurisdictions. So I just wanted to clarify that. I didn't want to sell Donald short.
Okay, well, I'm going to agree with you on the first four, but I'm going to disagree on the second four, because he's going to be indicted in Washington, D.C. by Jack Smith on both indictments. So he's going to be in
possible.
The federal district court in Washington.
Yeah.
They're not going to file it in Florida and give him a chance to move it to loose cannon up in Fort mm-hmm. Pierce. That's not going to happen. And they're not taking – and there is a jury in Florida is more problematical than it is in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's going to indict him in Washington on both of them. Because remember, the act of removing those documents begins in Washington. Everything
right.
else he does follows the removal. So venue lies in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
The only place worse for him is if they turn that over to the Southern District of New York.
Yeah, Manhattan, right.
And said, you indict him on this. We'll put him on trial
right.
in Manhattan again, okay? That's coming. I have no doubt. Right now, based upon what's been leaked out that they have, that's a slam dunk case against him. An absolute slam dunk case. The only thing they can claim is mistake of law, that he made a mistake believing that he had the right to have that stuff. But when he was told he didn't, by everyone, he loses his mistake of law defense.
Mm-hmm.
Because now it's not reasonable. So I have a feeling that that's the only place he can go with that. I had the right. I have the right to get paid. And he tipped his hand. He just gave away his real incentive for keeping all those documents. He wanted to get paid. He wanted more money than Nixon got. If Nixon got $18 million in 1976, then this has got to be worth $1 billion. I want the government to pay me for them. No, they belong to us. We paid once letting you be president. That price is incalculable. Why would I pay you a second time for the same stuff? So, no, I don't see where his defense is. And when his lawyers are testifying against him, that basically, I'm going to stand on this, he's going to end up with if in fact he told a lawyer, I need an affidavit, go tell somebody to write an affidavit and sign it, and they got Ellis, the lawyer Ellis, whatever her first name is, to sign the affidavit, that lawyer is looking at a conspiracy count. So there could be conspiracy for subornation of perjury. There could be conspiracy to obstruct justice. The conspiracy to steal government documents. All of that's going to add up to decades of time that he could get. If he's smart, he'll push that case to be closed before any other case is, so he can at least keep his sentencing guideline level down. So be that as it may, that's coming. But let's talk about today a little bit.
Yeah.
We got a whole bunch of questions here, and I'm just going to go down the questions that you and I are going to talk about. Here's the first question I have, and we get this answer about 10:30. So if we keep our eyes on it, we'll find out, just how many people show up. How many demonstrators, not including Marjorie Taylor Greene, okay, because we know she's going to be there, okay, will show up on his behalf today? Now, she's holding a demonstration at 10:30 in front of the courthouse. Be interesting to see how many people show up. Don't think there'll be more than that, okay? All right? So we'll keep our eye on that. The next issue is how controlled are they going to be? Are they going to create the kind of demonstration that will absolutely result in a gag order? Okay? And is his plan for addressing a concession the number against him will be overwhelming for it? Okay? That is, Is that what he thinks is going to happen? Or is he going to find out when he makes this and the ratings come out that most of the people in this country are against him? So let's talk about that for a minute. How many people do you think are actually going to show up?
Yeah. I think Michael Cohen had the one of the lines of the day yesterday when, because there was already some small little gathering of people to support Trump, I guess outside Trump Tower. And Michael Cohen said, this looks more like a bake sale at a high school football game than a demonstration. I mean, it's pretty pathetic. I don't see throngs of people. After the way he threw all of his supporters under the bus on January 6th and thereafter, I don't see a whole lot of people going for that again.
I don't see it either. Again, could be wrong, but I don't think that he's going to get the kind of crowds that he thinks he's going to get.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't. I think that it's unreasonable for him to believe that all these people are going to start showing up. I just don't see it. I could be wrong. Didn't
yeah,
mean to happen.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm trying to figure out, you know, exactly who's going to take a day off to go to Manhattan, okay, and go demonstrate for Donald. I just don't see that kind of thing happening. I really don't.
Well, you never know. You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is such a magnetic personality. You know, I mean.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, all of her followers from Georgia are going to come.
Yeah, right.
They made the 24-hour trip up to New York City, okay, to turn around and go home.
Right.
I think that the most he's got, and that was 24-hour Trump watch yesterday. When is he leaving? Oh, there is his motorcade. We have live cameras on his airplane. We're watching baggage handlers, okay? Empty other airplanes, okay? Okay, oh, he's here. There he goes up the stairs. Let's follow the airplane out onto the runway. Okay, and then we'll watch it sail off to the north, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then they said there, he's going to arrive any minute now. It's a 3-hour flight. He's going to arrive in New York any minute now, okay? And then you have live coverage of planes landing at LaGuardia, okay? Oh, there he is. There his plane is. It's going to land now, okay? And then they watch it come in, and they open up the door. Up, there it is. Up. He came down the stairs and got into a car. Wow. Okay. Let's follow him all the way into Manhattan. Okay. Then he got out of his car and he waved. I don't know who. I don't know who he was waving to. He was waving towards the building. I have no idea who. No thumbs up, just a wave. And into the building. Up. Now he's in Trump Tower. Let's keep a watch on Trump Tower because you never know who's going to come in and out. So we'll have live feeds from Trump Tower for the next 24 hours until he goes to court. Okay, that's what we saw on CNN. Okay, that's what we saw on Fox. Even when they weren't actually the whole screen, there was a little square in the bottom of the screen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's just play into his narrative. Let's make him the center of the earth. Okay? I mean, you know what? John Gotti didn't get that kind of coverage. And he was a real live, honest to goodness, you know, mafia guy who'd beaten 3 charges already. Seriously. I do not understand. I do not, and I will not understand this. Why are we doing this? And now instead of just talking tonight, he's going to talk before he goes into the courtroom. He's going to talk when he comes out of the courtroom. Okay. He is controlling the media, and the media has to say, okay, you are arraigned. Have a nice day. This was the worst day of your life. You got fingerprinted, and you were marched in the courtroom. And we finally figured out why the Trump people didn't want live cameras. Do you know why they didn't want live cameras, Brendan?
No.
Okay. Their claim was that it would be disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's the reason? Do you think Donald Trump cares if it's disruptive?
Right. Oh, God.
Okay. The real reason why is because he has to sit in a chair with a judge sitting on a bench above him. And when he is told to stand, he has to stand. And when he's told to enter a plea, all he's allowed to say is not guilty, Your Honor. And he has to call that person Your Honor. He is subservient to a guy from Colombia. Do you know how demeaning to his people that is for him? How diminishing of his power that is? He's not in charge. He will not be allowed to speak. There will be other things going on, scheduling and things like that. He has nothing to do with that. He has to sit in a chair until the judge says, is there anything further from the parties? We stand in recess. And then he has to get out because it's not his courtroom. That's why they don't want cameras in there. And that's why I think there should be cameras. So that people can see that even the highest people are laid low when they stand in the dock. Do you agree with that?
I do. And I thought that was the judge's first mistake. We'll see how many more he makes.
He should have let everybody see him put Donald Trump and call him Mr. Trump, not President Trump, not former president. He is Mr. Trump. And if he's asked to call him President Trump, he's going to say, we only have one president at a time. In this place, it is the people of the state of New York versus Donald Trump, Mr. Donald Trump. And that's how he will be referred to in this courtroom. And that includes you, counsel. My first ruling for the trial is you will not refer to him as President Donald Trump. That would have been a moment. Do you agree?
I do. I think it was a big mistake. Not a good start.
No, but he can make up for it. Sir, I watched your little speech when you were coming into the courtroom. I was dismayed that you would say such things. I don't hold it against you, but this isn't going to happen again. I'm entering a gag order. I had one prepared in case I needed it. You will not speak of this litigation, other than to say I believe I'm innocent, and I look forward to my day in court. Other than that, you may not speak of this litigation in any way, shape, or form. And if you do so, you will be found in contempt by this court. God, I wish it was me.
Do you think he'll do it?
I don't know. That depends
on
the scope. I there's a lot of people who don't think so, but remember, you know, he has been talking and bad-mouthing the judge and the prosecutor all weekend long. He's goading this guy into blowing up at him. And what he has to do is very calmly say, that type of conduct is not tolerated by this court or any other court. You are entitled to your opinions. You're not entitled to prejudice your own jury. So therefore, I'm entering a gag order, and that applies to counsel also. And please understand, sir, that anybody who speaks of the things that I told you can't speak about will have to answer one simple question. Were you asked to do that by the defendant in this case? You cannot do indirectly what you can't do directly. And that includes your family. It includes anybody employed by you. It includes your counsel. You will be responsible. Your job is to make sure that nobody does those things. And you can do that. You can make him responsible for the acts of other people if he fails to try to ameliorate those things happening. So I'm looking forward to that. So I'm looking forward to seeing how many people actually watch this thing tonight at 8 o'clock or 8:15 or whatever it is. How many cover it? I will be immensely disappointed if CNN puts that on live or MSNBC or ABC, NBC, CBS, any of the major networks. I know One America will, and I know full well that Fox will. So he can talk to his followers all he wants to. He's gonna, I don't think he should be allowed to talk to the American people with the things he's probably planning on saying. But we'll find out. And that's my next question. Will all the networks cover his prime time address, or will it only be One America and Fox? What do you think? Not talking live.
Yeah, I don't think they'll cover it live. Yeah. You can almost guarantee that MSNBC won't. You know, their anchors don't like contributing to his criminality. I think it's newsworthy. Obviously, you can't tell a news editor that it's not newsworthy, but that doesn't mean it's worthy of being covered live.
Correct.
You know, they can summarize what he says, and again, if there is a gag order, there's not much he can say. So we'll see how that goes. But I think it's going to be Fox and OAN and News, whatever it is, Newsmax or whatever the hell it's called, these crackpot types of outfits that cover it live. Is that your guess as well?
Yeah, that is pretty much what I think. I think that if he says anything that's newsworthy, they'll cover it. But if he doesn't say anything newsworthy, they can just say made a primetime address at 8:15 last night and basically said everything that he's been saying before, which does not bear repeating.
Mm-hmm.
And just say, I'm not going to let you control the narrative. And CNN has to take – yesterday they lost complete control of the narrative. They lost complete control of themselves. Okay? They got to get back on course. ABC, CBS, and NBC did not carry it live, and there was very little of a story yesterday, at least, that showed anything with him or anything he said. So, you know, and that's the way it should be covered.
Yeah.
Okay, there are things that happen inside a courtroom when there is a preliminary type of proceeding. And there doesn't have to be a finding of probable cause because there's an indictment, so we don't have to go through that part of the proceeding. So here's the first question. Will Donald Trump waive the reading of his indictment in open court, or will they insist that the judge read the entire indictment? What do you think, Brendan?
I think they'll waive it. I don't know. I don't know what they stand to gain, unless you've thought of something that they gain from the reading of it, aside from wasting time.
Right.
And annoying
prolonging
the judge.
The proceeding. Yeah, making the proceeding. Right. The only thing that it does is it makes the proceeding less rope than it normally would be. Because here's the way it normally goes, okay? You've been indicted, and immediately the defense attorney stands up and says, we've been provided with a copy of the indictment. We waive reading of the indictment and the charges therein. Because they give a judge the opportunity to read an indictment, a speaking indictment of everything that he did, and it's coming out of the judge's mouth. I can't see any reason why they would not waive, other than they just want to give this judge a hard time.
Yeah.
And make him read it out loud. And you know what? He'll read it out loud. These are the charges against you, sir. Count one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Or here's the preamble, the facts, okay? This is a speaking indictment, and this is the preamble of the facts that they're operating under. And 10, 12 pages later, they might say, well, Judge, you don't have to read the rest. Sir, you've asked me to read the indictment. I'm going to read the indictment.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to pick and choose. I'm either reading the indictment or I'm not. You said you wanted me to, so it's going to happen. So they have to make that decision. Other than, now, what sometimes happens in an arraignment, which is nothing more than how do you plead to the indictment? That's the question. A lot of times the judge, the lawyer will stand up and say, so-and-so on behalf of the defendant, former President Donald Trump, counsel, he's Mr. Donald Trump, or just Donald Trump. On behalf of him, I'm entering a plea of not guilty. Now, the judge doesn't have to accept that. He can say, I'm sorry, counsel, the defendant will have to enter his plea himself. Mr. Trump, will you please rise? How do you plead to the indictment? Guilty or not guilty? Judge, I have something I want to say. There's only two words you can use, one or the other. Three words. You either use guilty, which is one word, or not guilty, which is two words. That's the only answer I want. This is not your forum, sir. So what happens? Do you think he lets the lawyer enter the plea, or does he make Donald do it himself?
I'll bet he lets the lawyer do it.
Okay. I'm going to disagree with you on that, because generally speaking, lawyers in New York courts are not allowed to enter pleas. The judges absolutely insist, okay, that the defendant do it himself. And I think he has to show that Donald is going to be treated like everybody else in his courtroom. Okay, in Florida, for example, you can enter a written plea of not guilty and not even show up. The lawyer can file a written plea, and you can waive that appearance. And the lawyer doesn't, nobody has to show up. There's a written plea in the file, you've now been arraigned. But that doesn't exist there. I think he's going to make him talk just to let him know who's
so.
In charge.
Yeah.
I think he will, but we'll find out.
Yeah.
We talked about this before, whether he'll enter a gag order. We've talked about this. And if so, what effect would that have on tonight's supposed national address?
Yeah.
What do you think?
There, a gag order in this case would raise serious concerns, issues about the First Amendment, because there's no disputing that this is a matter of grave public concern. And the most protected speech under the First Amendment is speech that is of public concern, right? So I hope if he is going to issue a gag order, and I agree with you, he better have one ready, that it's been very carefully tailored. I don't think there would be a First Amendment issue. An underlying principle in First Amendment cases is that there's sort of a balancing between the value of the speech and the harm that it causes. There's no absolute right to free speech. If you incite violence, that's not protected speech. If you try to start a fight, right, by using words, that's not protected speech. Obscenity is not protected speech. True threats are not protected speech. And that's how I would tailor this if I was the judge. Say, okay, you're not allowed to do the following things. You know, you're not allowed to say anything that would incite violence. You're not allowed to say anything that would constitute a threat to the prosecutor, to this court. Along those lines, just to carefully tailor it, because there's no question there'd be litigatable, let's put it that way, colorable issues here if a gag order is imposed. I don't know. Maybe you do. I don't. If there is a gag order, would that be grounds for some kind of interlocutory appeal up the ladder? While the case is ongoing? I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, I would say that I understand what you're saying about this being a matter of great public interest, but there have been a lot of very high-profile cases where the litigants and the lawyers have been gagged. One, because they don't want them attempting to intimidate and or influence the jury before it's been selected. Mm-hmm. Number two, if I were writing a gag order, I would look down and say, I'm doing this for your own good, Mr. Trump, even though you may not think so. Because the more you talk, the more things you say, the more you may
right.
influence a jury pool of your guilt or innocence. And that could work against you. And because of that, if you do those things, you will not have the ability to raise any issues relating to difficulties in finding a jury in Manhattan or anywhere in the city of New York, because you will have created your own prejudice. And that's not mm-hmm. grounds. And we'll be keeping track of all the things you do. Everything you do is public. And we'll be keeping track of it. And we'll be keeping track of the things you say. And you will not be able to voir dire a jury based upon the things that you said. Did that influence you in any way? Because you've done it to yourself. So I'm going to protect you from you. And that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this. And I would add on, you will say nothing that denigrates the prosecutor or denigrates this court in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You are restricted to just saying, I'm letting the criminal justice system play out. I'm not guilty. But going into specifics of your case, you may not speak of. And I don't think this violates your First Amendment rights because it protects your Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment rights and your due process rights under the 14th Amendment. I'm going to protect you from you. That's what he can do. I don't know whether he will, but that's what he can do. I'm looking at a live feed right now from the courthouse. Mm-hmm. I don't see Marjorie Taylor Greene, and I don't see a demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 10:30.
Right.
Okay? Nice to see you, Mag. So that's what I think. If he wants to take control of his courtroom, if he
right.
wants to take control over this litigation, this is something I think he needs to do. And if Donald talks
right.
in the hallway before he walks in, that will be the last straw. And that would basically end his address to the nation, which is a campaign address, which means nobody's going to cover it. You might as well video it and hand it out to everybody. That's what I think. But, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
What do I know?
That's like I said
okay.
last time we talked. I mean, you know, it's gonna be incumbent on this judge. I know he's well respected, but this is gonna be the test. And I hope he went to the Judge Ito school of how not to conduct a trial. And he does. He has to exert control. I'm worried, based on his opening salvo here, where he went along with Trump's lawyers and not allowing cameras. You know, that makes me a little skeptical that he's going to be in control of this. We'll see. I hope he proves me wrong.
Well, I'm satisfied that he's allowing still cameras. So there will be still photographs of Donald Trump standing below the judge, okay, and facing up to the judge. And he is going to have to use and address the court in a manner in which every other defendant does. Yes, Judge. Yes, Your Honor. And if he doesn't, if I were the judge, I would look down at his counsel and say, counsel, would you please instruct your client on the proper way to address this court? I mean, I think he can do that. So let's find out. But I don't think that actual live feed, okay, does anything for us. Most defendants, almost all defendants, with very few exceptions, have live feeds of their arraignments. And I don't think this should be one of them. You should treat
yeah,
him
I,
like a
I disagree.
Common criminal.
I disagree.
I know you do.
It's, but for the reasons that you opened up with, that the last thing they wanted was film of this, of Donald Trump diminishing himself in front of this court. And that's an image that we should have been able to see. And but we're not going to see it.
I think the still photographs will give us some of it. I agree with you. It won't be everything that it should be. But I have to take the position that he may have accepted that Trump feeds up on live cameras. He will show his facial disdain for this judge. There's no issue about that.
Mm-hmm.
And why give him the opportunity to do that with a live feed? So to a certain extent, it gives the judge, I think, a better chance to control what happens inside of his courtroom. So, you know, the problem is that when you have cameras in the courtroom, at least initially, in any case in which cameras are there, live cameras are there, people play up to those cameras. After a while, they get used to them being there, and they don't do that. But they do it. And I think that he wants to go through this, get it done as quickly as possible, and throw his ass out of the courtroom. Be able to look at him and say, we're in recess. Mr. Trump, you are excused. We'll see how he ends it. Let's talk about what we have to expect legally over the next several months. First of all, everybody's projecting, gee, we'll be lucky if we get this case to trial before the election in 2024. Do you agree with that?
Could you repeat that? You cut out for a second.
Okay. There's a lot of people who are saying, we'll be lucky to get this case to trial before the election in 2024. Do you agree with that?
No. No, there's no reason that this should drag on that long. Yeah.
No. And let me tell you, and this is where I'd like to, in where you disagree or you have additional things, you tell me what to expect legally. The first thing we know we're going to get is a very lengthy motion to dismiss,
mm-hmm.
attacking every single count and claiming it doesn't state a cause of action. The major one that I understand is going to be that the state of New York does not have the power to adopt federal statute as a basis for a felony being committed when he created the false business records. I think that falls flat on its face. But that will be probably the most major motion. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They can make reference to any kind of felony anywhere. It doesn't have to be a New York felony.
Right. It doesn't even have to be a felony. It just has to be a crime.
Yeah, a crime of sorts. So it'll be lengthy. I think that there will not be oral argument. I think this judge is going to avoid oral argument whenever possible. So that's the first motion I think we all know we're going to see. There will be a motion for change of venue. They want to get out to Staten Island where there's a lot of Republicans. Mm-hmm. I don't think they get there. But that and you have to try to pick a jury before you can say we're going to change venue. There has to be some sort of sense of impossibility, and it's not impossible for him to get a jury. Jurors don't have to say, I don't know anything about this case.
Right.
They don't even have to say that they don't have an opinion. What they have to say is that they agree that they have to set aside their opinions and make the decision solely on the evidence that's presented in the courtroom, and yes, I can do that. Thus, they are qualified to be a juror. Because there's nobody in the United States who's going to say they don't know anything about this case.
Right. That's right.
And very few that are going to say I don't have an opinion. So I don't see how he gets out of Manhattan. And let's admit it, they hate him in Manhattan. There's no person
right.
more abhorred in Manhattan than Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, what do you think about that?
Which is why he's getting on his airplane immediately after the arraignment, flying back to Florida. He must feel the hate in the air. They'd be left arguing that there is no difference between people in Staten Island and people in Manhattan. as to whether they are aware of this case. And then, I mean, they're all in New York City. They all know about it. So you're left there basically saying, you know, the only reason we want to go to Staten Island is because of politics, and that's not a legitimate reason for a change in venue. So I don't see that happening either. I think the trial will be in Manhattan.
I don't think that they're going to give up on Manhattan. I don't think that's going to happen. I agree with
you.
The next thing is some stuff that he thinks he can get the federal courts involved in this litigation. And that is a motion to exclude certain evidence based upon executive privilege and trying to relitigate that issue again. Okay. I think he tries to litigate that issue again, tries to exclude evidence prior to trial on a motion in limine, and then when he doesn't win, try to get this case into federal court. That's what I think. Now, I could be wrong, but I don't see it. But they're going to try to get into federal court. You have to understand. You're going to try to get the federal courts involved in this somehow.
Right.
That's how he attempts to prolong the litigation, because he can't prolong it in front of this judge. He has to get another court involved. Okay.
Right.
I don't think he gets into federal court.
Nope. It should take a federal judge 5 minutes to abstain from hearing any kind of issue like that. How many times do federal judges have to say this, right? State court judges, are answerable to the supremacy clause in the Constitution. They're perfectly capable of applying federal law and interpreting the Constitution just like a federal judge can. And if you raise federal issues in the trial court, you can raise them again in your appeal. And if you preserve it all the way up to the Supreme Court, you know, ultimately, if the highest court in the state rejects your arguments, you can apply for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's how the system works. You're not going to be doing parallel litigation in both court systems. That's, Judge, unless it's Lee's Tannen, I don't see a federal judge biting on that.
Yeah, a federal judge, the only way that I think he gets into federal court is when he is convicted, because I think he will be. When he is convicted, at least based upon the evidence that we know so far, there may be things we don't know. But based upon the case as we understand it now, oh, by the way, hooray, I'm watching a live feed of Finland putting up the NATO flag. Okay.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that is nice. Isn't that nice? I love that. Okay, I think that he doesn't get into federal court unless after he has exhausted all of his appeals, he finds some way to claim that all of these lawyers that he's paying millions of dollars to were awful and terrible and ineffective assistance of counsel and move for a writ of habeas corpus.
Right.
That's the best that he can hope for, and that is years down the pike.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, he'll be done playing golf because he can't get out of the cart by the time that comes around, okay? So that's kind of the way I look at it. There's a thing called a motion in limine. It sounds like what it is for those that are listening. It's a motion of limitation of sorts to prevent the introduction of evidence. It's also used as a basis to get evidence get the court to rule that certain evidence is admissible and allow it in under the rules of evidence. He will file a motion in limine to prevent what would they call 403 evidence. Not 403, I'm sorry. 403 is using 403 is one thing. I'm trying to remember, is it 402 that is, I always thought it was 403 that was the similar transaction in prior bad acts. Is that 403? I can't remember. I don't have my rules in front of me at the moment.
Let's call it
403.
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds
nobody
good.
Cares
I never
anyway.
Taught evidence.
You've explained
yeah,
what
okay.
it is. Yeah.
Okay. There is a thing where that technically, as a general rule, evidence of prior bad acts is not admissible into evidence in your case. They can't show what a bad guy you are because you did a bunch of other stuff. The only way evidence of bad things that you did before comes in is if you've been convicted and if you take the stand, the prosecution has the right to ask if you've ever been convicted of a felony or a crime of moral turpitude, like lying or stealing. And if your answer is yes, then you can ask how many times have you been convicted, and then they have to answer that question. If they don't answer it truthfully, then you can bring in each and every conviction and the evidence of and the proof of those convictions with documents and fingerprints and things like that, okay, to prove that you have been convicted of a number of prior bad acts. In addition to that, the prosecution can say, we have evidence of prior crimes which show a pattern of conduct on the part of the defendant that help establish that there was no mistake of fact, mistake of law that took place here, and that there is knowledge on the part of the defendant that the acts that he has committed are criminal in nature. Or you can show a plan, a course of conduct, to show that he's done exactly the same thing before. In this particular case, I think that if Karen I think her first name is Karen, but her last name is McDougal, is the other woman who got paid by the Inquirer, by AMI, okay, to kill her story of a long-standing affair that she had with Donald Trump when Melania was pregnant with the youngest son, Barron. There could be counts in this indictment that relate to that. Because those would be unlawful acts and claiming he did it for the purposes of helping his campaign, and that Pecker was the guy who assisted, and there's where a conspiracy count would come into play. You know, Michael Cohen named as an unindicted co-conspirator, Pecker named as an unindicted co-conspirator. Okay, so those could be counts in this indictment. I don't know. I think there's a lot of things we don't know about this indictment. However, if it's not, there could be a motion in limine filed by the government, by the state, to introduce that evidence as course of conduct, to show that he had done it before and he did the same thing here, before he ever gets a chance to take the stand, or as rebuttal if he does take the stand. And he'll file a motion limiting to prevent any such evidence from ever coming in. He may move for a severance of the counts involving McDougal from the counts involving, Stormy Daniels. I don't know. Those things could happen. Those are all evidentiary motions which will not take long for the judge to make a decision. One of the things he will do is that I'm going to withhold decision on those. We're going to trial. I'll make up my mind as the evidence is produced, and I will determine under it's 404 evidence. 403 evidence is evidence which is relevant, or even though it be relevant, it is so prejudicial that it should not be introduced into evidence. Okay, yeah. That's 403. Okay, and if in fact he'll file under 403 and say this evidence is the prejudicial value outweighs its probative value, is a phrase that they use. And again, he can say, I'll make that decision when it comes time for that evidence to be introduced. Counsel for the government, before you put a witness on the stand to testify to those matters, please advise the court and I will render a decision on the motion. Okay? And thus they will not get the pretrial ruling that they want. A lot of this stuff, there may not be pretrial rulings. I believe, and this is the next question, how quick a trial date will this judge set, and will he be able to keep the pedal to the metal? What do you think?
I don't see anything about this case that's terribly complicated. And, you know, that goes to a broader point. When people are trying to make it out like this is a minor stuff that isn't worth going to trial over, just a reminder to everybody, Donald Trump's lawyer went to jail for this exact transaction. And in fact, according to the prosecutors who put Michael Cohen in jail, did what he did at the direction of Donald Trump. So, so I see this as not the most complicated. I think you're right that there's one legal wrinkle that they've got to figure out about the use of the federal. If in fact they do, we'll find out. But if they use federal law as sort of a predicate for a state charge, that's a legal thing. That's not a jury question. That's a question for the judge. I'm saying 6 months, you know, I get this thing to trial in 6 months is a reasonable time if he can do it again, if he keeps control of the proceedings.
I happen to agree with you. I don't think he's going to set a trial date today. What I think he may do, is set a, scheduling conference,
mm-hmm.
3 weeks. I want to know I want discovery completed from the government. Within 2 weeks after that, I want discovery completed by the defense, witness list, all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Motions will be filed within a certain time, and we're going to trial in October. That is sufficient time for everyone to be ready for trial. And so, therefore, I'm setting it out 6 months, but that's all the time you're going to get. I will not entertain motions for continuances. Mr. Trump, you have more lawyers than most law firms have. I think mm-hmm. you can get this done in time to be ready for trial. Now, that's what I think. I think he'll keep the pedal to the metal. He wants to be rid of this case as quickly as he possibly can be. And I personally think Jack Smith would love it if it was, because that will – a conviction for felonies will up his Donald's guideline ranges should he be convicted in federal court.
Right.
It would almost guarantee that he's going to have to be incarcerated. He won't get the first-time conviction benefit. And the same thing goes in Georgia. So I think he keeps the pedal to the metal. Here's another question. I was watching the interview with the last prosecutor, state prosecutor from Manhattan. And he kind of intimated that there's more out there.
Yeah.
For state charges. Okay, well, that actually did not sound to me like Avon calling. Remember that ding dong Avon calling? I know that's before most people were born. The population was much smaller when I heard those things. Hey, you're there. Do you think that Bragg has more? Do you think Bragg would indict him again on other charges?
I don't know. I did think it was interesting that Cy Vance said that he was the reason he didn't go after this was because the Southern District of New York, the feds, told him to stand, quote-unquote, to stand down. And he found it very unusual that after telling him to stand down from investigating this crime, they did not pursue it. And he seemed like he was very curious about why that would be. I don't know what Bragg has, but so somebody at the Department of Justice is going to have to answer some questions. If Cy Vance is telling the truth, why did Donald Trump's Department of Justice tell New York State a New York State prosecutor or ask him to stand down and then not pursue it themselves? Somebody needs to answer that question.
Well, part of that is why did they get rid of Preet Bharara?
Right.
Okay. Clearly, I can understand why the SDNY, who had its sovereignty, because it's known as the Sovereign District of New York.
Mm-hmm.
But why the SDNY stood down was because the U.S. attorney was told by the attorney general to stand down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, and that was after the state was told to stand down. What I want to know is why, if that was the case, why the SDNY in January of 2001, 2 years ago, didn't resurrect this. I want to know what happened. I think it's a legitimate question. That wasn't Donald Trump's SDNY. Now, part of it may be that Cy Vance was investigating a RICO count and that they didn't want to step on Cy Vance's RICO count. That's very possible. And that may be the reason or the excuse it's given. But it's still got a problem. Why did it fall on the Manhattan District Attorney to bring these charges when they had already named Trump as an unindicted co-conspirator, individual number one? All they had to do was take out that old indictment and replace it with Michael Cohen as the co-conspirator and the operative, but he cannot be charged again because of double jeopardy, and put Donald Trump's name in place of individual number one. That's all they had to do, and arrest his butt and put him on trial. So I don't understand. And I put that one on guard.
Yeah, yeah. As
I understand
so much.
January 6th it happened. I understand January 6th it happened, but that one's on Garland.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll leave it at that point.
Yep.
I think Bragg's got more. I just don't know whether he's going to do it or not.
Right.
So very briefly, because we've used up our hour, we're over already. There are three other jurisdictions that are pending indictments. The last we've heard is that the first week of May, Atlanta, Fulton County prosecutor will seek and obtain an indictment against Donald Trump. I think there will be other defendants, and I think there will be conspiracy counts. And I think that you will shortly thereafter see an indictment in Mar-a-Lago. I don't think Jack's ready to indict him on January 6th yet.
Right, right.
And it may be that he will hold that over Donald's head. You will plead guilty to these obstruction charges if you want to stay out of jail and you don't want me to indict you on the other one. If you insist on a trial on Mar-a-Lago, I am going to indict you for January 6th. And if you are convicted on any of that, you will spend the rest of your life in prison. He's going to treat him like any mob boss.
No.
So we'll see. But I think that by the first day of summer, he will have two other cases pending against him.
Yeah.
Okay. As I said last week, and as Winston Churchill said after the Battle of Britain was won, this is not the beginning of the end. It is not the end. But it is the end of the beginning. Okay? And I'll leave it at that.
Yep.
So that's what I think. By the way, as of right now, there are no demonstrations in front of Trump Tower. There are no demonstrations at the courthouse. I have not seen Marjorie Taylor Greene's face, which is a good thing, by the way, because I don't really particularly like her face. Okay. I have not heard her voice. That's even worse than looking at her face. Okay. So at this point, I don't think you're going to see massive demonstrations. I really don't.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we said that a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether that'll have any effect on whether he really does want to give this speech tonight. I had the highest ratings of the night. Really, you had 500,000 people watching it. The Bachelor had 10 million. okay? And you ain't the bachelor, okay? All right. All right, Rezzy, you get your air back.
Yeah.
My compatriot
thank you very
has
much,
a
guys.
Meeting to prepare for, a meeting he does not want to go to or attend, okay?
That would be every meeting, right?
Yeah. But you're in control of this meeting, so you have to go. Okay?
Yeah.
That's just the way it works for you, pal. Sorry about that.
I know.
Yes, I know. You're going to punish
you
me for that in the end. Yeah, it's my fault. I got it. It's my fault.
Yeah,
I understand.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right.
All the best to you, Brendan. All the best.
All right. And you too.
We'll
happy Easter, guys.
Oh, no, no.
Happy
yeah,
Easter,
good
Easter, happy Passover.
You're wishing me a happy Easter?
Knock them Brendan,
off.
Too?
Okay. Okay, knock them off, okay, with a happy Easter. Okay? Okay.
Oh, God.
Okay? Okay? And depending on how things go, I might be back tomorrow to talk to you for a little bit. You let me know what's going on. We'll see what happens today.
Hello.
Okay, whether it's even worth talking about. Okay?
Okay.
All righty. Thanks, Hezzy.
Thank you both.
Okay, everybody.
All the best.
I'll see you in about an hour,
Brad.
I might be
all
a little
right.
late,
yep.
but I'll be there, okay? Am I excused
all
for
right.
the first 10 minutes or so? Thank you. I appreciate it.
I'll think about it. All right.
Okay.
All right.
Talk to you later, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Be well, guys. Oh, it doesn't get better than both of these gentlemen. Absolutely superb. It just is what it is. What can I tell you? So let's look at some other things that you might find of interest. Quickly go back first to see what's going on. I don't remember exactly what I have on the front page of the Yonkers Tribune. And I think there were some things I wanted to cover with you. One second here. Where is it here? Well, this was really quite important. This comes from the Internal Revenue Service. They talk about the Dirty Dozen, and they assert that we should be aware of abusive tax avoidance schemes. So the Internal Revenue Service closed out the 2023 Dirty Dozen campaign with a warning for taxpayers to be aware of promoters peddling bogus tax schemes aimed at reducing tax or avoiding them altogether. These schemes can take many shapes, ranging from abusive deals involving syndicated conservation easements and micro-captive insurance arrangements. They can also involve an international component, such as hiding cash and digital assets offshore, or using Maltese foreign individual retirement accounts, or foreign captive insurance. These tax avoidance strategies often target high-income individuals seeking to reduce or eliminate their tax obligation, said the IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel. Sometimes taxpayers are conned into believing they can participate in these schemes. People should always look for advice from an independent, trusted tax professional, not a promoter focused on aggressively marketing and pushing questionable transactions. This marks the final day of the IRS annual Dirty Dozen campaign, a list of 12 scams and schemes that put taxpayers and the tax professional community at risk of money, personal information, tax data, and more. And some items on the list are new, and some make a return visit. While the list is not a legal document or a formal listing of agency enforcement priorities, it is intended to alert taxpayers and the tax professional community about various scams and schemes at large. So there are quite a few here. So let me just review them with you. The micro-captive insurance arrangements, also called a small captive, a micro-captive is an insurance company whose owners elect to be taxed on the captive's investment income only. Abusive micro-captives involve schemes that lack many of the attributes of legitimate insurance. These structures often include implausible risks, failure to match genuine business needs, and in many cases, and unnecessary duplication of the taxpayers' commercial coverages. In addition, the premiums paid under these arrangements are often excessive, reflecting non-arm's length pricing. Abusive micro-captive transactions continue to be a high-priority enforcement area for the IRS. The IRS has won all micro-captive tax court and appellate court cases decided on their merits since 2017. Syndicated conservation easements. A conservation easement is a restriction on the use of real property. Generally, taxpayers may claim a charitable contribution deduction for the fair market value of a conservation easement transferred to a charity if the transfer meets the requirements of Internal Revenue Code Section 170. Excuse me. Syndicated conservation easements are arrangements that make the Dirty Dozen list again in 2023. In abusive arrangements, promoters are syndicating conservation easement transactions that purport to give an investor the opportunity to claim charitable contribution deductions and corresponding tax savings that significantly exceed the amount of investor invested. These abusive arrangements, which generate high fees for promoters, attempt to game the tax system with grossly inflated tax deduction. As part of the Consolidated Appropriation Act of 2023, Congress amended Section 170 to curb certain abusive conservation easement transactions. The IRS is committed to ensuring compliance with the conservation easement deduction law as amended in the 2023 legislation, and will continue to scrutinize transactions that are too good to be true. Schemes with international elements. Offshore accounts and digital assets. International tax compliance remains a high priority for the IRS. The IRS continues to scrutinize taxpayer attempts to hide assets in offshore accounts and accounts holding digital assets such as cryptocurrency. The IRS reminds U.S. persons that they are taxable on their worldwide income unless they can establish there is a statutory or treaty exemption. The IRS continues to identify individuals who attempt to conceal income in offshore banks, brokerage accounts, digital asset accounts, and nominee entities. The IRS scrutinizes structured transactions, private annuities, employee leasing schemes, foreign trusts, the use of nominee ownership, and other arrangements used to conceal taxable income, beneficial owners, and assets. To complement its enforcement investigations, the IRS requires individuals holding foreign assets and third parties to report to the IRS on foreign assets, foreign accounts, foreign entities, and digital assets. Reporting requirements carry penalties for failure to file. Now, asset protection professionals and unscrupulous promoters continue to lure U.S. persons into placing their assets in offshore accounts and structures, saying they're out of reach of the IRS. Similarly, unscrupulous promoters recommend digital assets as being untraceable and undiscoverable by the IRS, and these assertions are not true. The IRS can identify and track anonymous transactions of foreign financial accounts as well as digital assets. Many of these schemes are promoted and advertised online, but all these schemes have one thing in common. They promise tax savings that are too good to be true and will likely cause legal harm to taxpayers. Then there's the Maltese Individual Retirement Arrangements Misusing Treaty. These arrangements involve U.S. citizens or residents who attempt to avoid U.S. tax by contributing to foreign individual retirement arrangements in Malta for potentially other or potentially other host countries. the participants in these transactions typically lack any local connection to the host country, and unlike U.S. law for individual retirement arrangements, the host country's laws allow for contribution in a form other than cash and do not limit the amount of contribution by reference to employment or self-employment activities. By improperly asserting the foreign arrangement as a pension fund for U.S. tax treaty purposes, the U.S. taxpayer misconstrues the relevant treaty provisions and improperly claims an exemption from U.S. Income tax on gains and earnings in and distribution from the foreign retirement, individual retirement arrangement. Then there's also Puerto Rico and other foreign captive insurance. In these transactions, U.S. business owners of closely held entities participate in a purported insurance arrangement with a Puerto Rican or other foreign corporation in which the U.S. business owner has a financial interest. While the U.S. business owner or a related entity claims a deduction for amounts paid as premiums for insurance coverage, quote unquote, provided by a fronting carrier, which reinsures the coverage with the Puerto Rican or other foreign corporation. And despite being labeled as insurance, these arrangements lack many of the attributes of legitimate insurance, like the micro-captives described above. The characteristics of the purported insurance arrangement typically will include one or more of the following: implausible risks covered or duplicative coverage of risks already covered by commercial insurance, excessive premiums indicative of non-arm's length pricing, and a lack of business purpose for entering the arrangement. Where appropriate, the IRS will challenge the purported tax benefits from these types of transactions and impose penalties. The IRS Criminal Investigation Division is always on the lookout for promoters and participants of these types of schemes. Taxpayers should think twice before including questionable arrangements like this on their tax returns. After all, taxpayers are legally responsible for what's on their return, not a promoter making promises and charging high fees. Taxpayers can help stop these arrangements by relying on reputable tax professionals they know and trust. The IRS warns anyone thinking about using one of these schemes or similar ones that the agency continues to improve investigation and enforcement in these areas by utilizing new and evolving data analytic tools and enhanced document matching. Whether anchored offshore or in the United States, abusive transactions and schemes remain a high priority for the IRS. The IRS Office of the Chief Counsel continues to hire additional attorneys to help the agency combat abusive arrangements, including syndicated conservation easements, micro-captive transactions, and others. The IRS created the Office of Fraud Enforcement, the OFE, and Office of Promoter Investigations, the OPI, to coordinate service-wide enforcement activities against taxpayers committing tax fraud and promoters marketing and selling abusive tax avoidance transactions and schemes to effectuate tax evasion. How to report. As part of the Dirty Dozen awareness effort, the IRS encourages people to report individuals who promote improper and abusive tax schemes, as well as tax return preparers who deliberately prepare improper returns. To report an abusive tax scheme or a tax return preparer, people should mail or fax a completed form 14242, report suspected abusive tax promotions or preparers, and any supporting materials to the IRS Lead Development Center in the Office of Promoter Investigations. And you can address it by mail to the Internal Revenue Service Lead Development Center, Stop MS 5040, 24000, Avila, Avila Road, Laguna Niguel, L-A-G-U-N-A. Niguel is N-I-G-U-E-L, California, 926-77-3405. And if you prefer, you can always fax information to them. The number there is 877-477-9135. And you can find this also on the Yonkers Tribune under Dirty Dozen. So that's part of the issue there. Now, bear with me a second here because I want to cover some other news with you. Bear with me. This is really monumental news. Finland has officially become a NATO member. Finland has joined NATO, dramatically widening Russia's frontier with the Transatlantic Defense Alliance. The Kremlin has described the accession as, quote, an assault on our security, end quote. Finland became 31st member of the NATO military alliance on Tuesday, that's today, amid warnings of countermeasures, quote unquote, from the Kremlin. Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year prompted Finland, which has a 800-mile border with Russia and its neighbor Sweden, to drop decades of military non-alignment. So how is the accession being marked? On Tuesday afternoon, Finland's foreign minister handed the accession papers to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, the keeper of NATO's founding treaty. Finland's blue and white flag was then set to be hoisted alongside those of its new allies, alphabetically placed between the flags of Estonia and France in front of NATO headquarters in Brussels. During the ceremony, Blinken took a jab at Russian President Vladimir Putin. I'm tempted to say this is maybe the one thing that we can thank Mr. Putin for, because he once again here precipitated something he claims to want to prevent by Russia's aggression, causing many countries to believe that they have to do more to look out for their own defense and to make sure that they can deter possible Russian aggression going forward, end quote, Blinken said, just before accepting the documents that made Finland's membership official. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg echoed the sentiment. Quote, President Putin wanted to slam NATO's door shut. Today we show the world that he failed, that aggression and intimidation do not work, Stoltenberg had said. Finnish security expert Henri van Heinen advised Deutsche Welle, the German World newspaper, the invasion of Ukraine last year marked the start of a new era. The masks have been removed, and we sort of see the real face of Putin right now, he said. And I think in the foreseeable future, it will be difficult to see a sort of return to any sort of normal relationship with the Russians, at least as long as the current administration is in place. The United Kingdom wants Sweden to join next. Well, Helsinki will work relentlessly, quote unquote, to secure Sweden's membership of NATO, pledged Finnish President Sauli Niinisto on Tuesday. Finland's membership is not complete without Swedish membership, Niinisto said in a statement. The kingdom also urged the military alliance to admit Sweden next. Quote, all NATO members now need to take the steps necessary to admit Sweden too, so we can stand together as one alliance to defend freedom in Europe and across the world, Sunak said in a statement after Finland officially joined. Finland's accession came as NATO foreign ministers met at the alliance's headquarters in Brussels for a two-day summit to discuss the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine. The meeting coincides with the 74th anniversary of the alliance's founding. Russia's NATO frontier doubles in strength. Russia's foreign ministry said that by joining the alliance, Finland had lost, quote, its self-identity and any independence. This forces us to take countermeasures, in tactical and strategic terms, said Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov. The enlargement of NATO's border with Russia has, quote, profoundly changed the situation, end quote, in Northern Europe, the ministry said. Finland's membership doubles Russia's border with NATO, the world's largest military alliance. Turkey and Hungary, for different reasons of their own, initially held up Finland's efforts to join Sweden's progress remains blocked. Achieving ratification is well under a year, still makes Finland's membership process the fastest in the alliance's recent history. Membership for Sweden is still dependent on Turkish ratification due to several sticking points, but Stoltenberg pointed out, quote, Sweden will also be safer as a result, end quote, of Finland's membership. He added that he expected Sweden will be able to join soon. So, so that's really, that's like a major, major move. Now let's look at some other issues, which hopefully you'll find interesting. This is about Pablo Picasso, and it's a question of reassessing the artist toxic masculinity. This is written by Sabine Oiz. Pablo Picasso is famous and infamous for the way he treated his wives, muses, and his mistresses. He saw them as either goddesses or doormats. It is time to knock the Spanish art icon off his pedestal. Quote, there are only two types of women, goddesses and doormats. This quote of Pablo Picasso speaks volumes. In fact, most of his relationships with women, 11 are known, follow just that pattern. First, he would idolize them. Then he would treat them like scum. Two of them, Marie-Thérèse Walter and Jacqueline Roque, committed suicide after Picasso's death. The controversial aspect of the legacy of the superstar of 20th century art is increasingly in the spotlight. Quote, I would accuse Picasso of being manipulative, of having a sadistic tendency, and of deriving a certain pleasure from torturing women in a certain way by making promises and vows of love to them, even if he didn't mean it, says Anne-Catherine Hahn, curator of the Picasso Museum in the German city of Münster. Women in particular often ask her how a museum can still celebrate such an artist as an idol without criticism, she says. Picasso, no scruples and hungry for power. Picasso, who was born in Spain in 1881 and died aged 91 in 1973 in France, was an unscrupulous genius willing to walk over dead bodies for his career. Some of his ex-lovers wrote in their memoirs, he had an almost manic way of immortalizing every one of his affairs in his paintings, drawings, sculpture, or ceramics. As enthusiastic as he was at the outset, that would cool just as quickly. Attraction and repulsion almost always followed the same pattern. Fernand Olivier was the first lover to make public the story of her relationship with Picasso in her 1933 book, quote, Picasso and His Friends, end quote. She recounts the years spent together in Paris from 1905 to 1913. When Picasso and Fernand met, he was an unknown, poor Spanish artist with a strong accent. Olivier was one of those most important models during the early years of his career. He broke down her image into geometric splinters, nose, eyes, and cheeks are hardly recognizable as such in his Cubist artworks. Picasso depicted the view from the front in the same time. Demoiselle d'Avignon, an expression of misogyny. Using Fernand's likeness, Picasso created milestones in the history of modern art. In real life, he treated her poorly and even locked her up in their shared studio apartment to prevent her from modeling for other artists. she faced poverty when he left her for her new, for his new lover, Eva Guez. Rose Maria Grupp researched Picasso's mistress's private diaries and unpublished sources for her 2023 book, Goddesses and Doormats, The Women and Picasso. The art journalist sees the iconic painting Demoiselle d'Avignon, a major work from Picasso's Cubist phase, as an expression of his contempt for women. Quote, after all, it's simply inconceivable to think of a painting as catastrophic as the 1907 Demoiselle d'Avignon without aggression on the part of its creator. It's impossible, she told Deutsche Welle, adding that it was just as interesting to see how the five penned-in women in the life-size paintings mirrored that destructive energy. Picasso was aware of the power of women, she argues. Though topple Picasso from his pedestal. Picasso despised women, says Abigail Solomon Godot, a Paris-based U.S. art scholar. From a feminist point of view, people should distance themselves from this kind of artist, she says, adding that it is time for a new perspective on Picasso. Quote, what I'm interested in is discourse of art history, discourses about Picasso, discourses about great genius, about masters, because it's a discourse that is open to interpretation for a painting, she advised Deutsche Welle. Quote, our perception of the painting Demoiselle d'Avignon is not the same as in 1907. We look with different eyes now, end quote. She adds that, that nowadays questions arose that, quote, could not be asked of the work 115 years ago, end quote. Solomon Godot would like to knock Picasso right off his pedestal. He was not superhuman, she says. The people shouldn't excuse his toxic masculinity by pointing out his Mediterranean character. After initial grace in the wake of his split from his first wife, Olga Kochlova, with whom he lived from 1917 to 1935, he distorted her image in his paintings into monstrosities. One painting shows Olga asleep on an armchair, a grotesquely deformed figure with a wide-open snout-like mouth. Women in competition. Françoise Gillot, the mother of Picasso's children, Paloma and Claude, wrote about the years 1943 to 1954 in her book, My Life with Picasso. While Fernand was penniless after the separation, Gillot was financially independent, coming from a well-to-do family. She saw Picasso for what he was and did not mince words. He always put people around him in competition, one woman against another, one art dealer against another, one friend against another. He was masterful at using one person as a red cloth and the other as a bull. While the bull went for the red cloth, Pablo was able to deliver painful blows, she wrote. Gillot left Picasso. She was the only woman to leave Picasso, and he never forgave her for it. For a long time, he even refused to acknowledge the paternity of their children. Wherever he could, Picasso humiliated his wives, including in his art. Dora Maar, who was one of his romantic partners, was considered psychologically unstable and suffered particularly from the artist's hurtful words. She will probably be remembered forever as the weeping woman, quote unquote, as it is how he depicted her in his paintings. Attraction and aversion. Picasso's relationship with his lovers almost always followed that pattern, says Munster Picasso Museum Director Marcos Mira. He and Marilyn McCulley published a 2022 book, quote, Picasso, Women of His Life, a homage, end quote. Picasso's daughter Maya once told me that Picasso left his wives like someone who goes out one more time in the evening to get cigarettes at the bistro, end quote. His contempt for women was also an expression of the times, and Picasso was not the only one. His friends Apollinaire and Paul Eluard were also erotomaniacs obsessed with sex, Muller says. Picasso's wives were usually younger than 30 at the time they met him, sometimes not even of age. Picasso, a macho obsessed with success, has been a much discussed topic in the art world since the hashtag MeToo movement emerged. Today, the people would probably describe him as a prime example of toxic masculinity. Fascinating. Literally fascinating. I never really understood the images that he portrayed on canvas, but reading this article that was written by Deutsche Welle, in Deutsche Welle, is enlightening, because now it makes more sense than it ever did before. Literally amazing, to say the least. Okay, now let's look at some other things. Bear with me a moment here. One second here. This is quite interesting when it comes to Japan. Evidently, the Japanese are struggling to strike a balance with respect to China. As Tokyo and Beijing try to find common ground amid rising tensions in the Indo-Pacific, experts say that Japan will find it tough to balance its ties to China and the United States. Japanese Foreign Minister Yoshimasa Hayashi met high-ranking Chinese officials, including Premier Li Qiang and Foreign Minister Qin Gang, on Sunday as both sides seek to find common ground and rising tensions in the region. This is the first trip to China's capital by a Japanese foreign minister in over 3 years and comes after Chinese authorities recently arrested a Japanese national working for the pharmaceutical group Astellas on espionage charges. According to the foreign ministry in Tokyo, at least 17 Japanese nationals have been detained by China on spying-related charges since 2014. Five Japanese nationals currently remain in Chinese detention, two of whom have already been tried and found guilty. While Hayashi called for transparency over the legal process regarding the detention, Kim responded that China, quote, will handle the case according to the law, end quote. Apart from seeking the swift release of the Japanese national, Hayashi and Kim also addressed other important bilateral issues, including the territorial dispute over a cluster of disputed islets in the East China Sea. Japan's decision to restrict the export of semiconductor manufacturing equipment, Beijing's aggressive military posture near Taiwan, and Tokyo's planned release of treated radioactive water from around the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant into the sea. Tokyo worries about the China-Russia ties. The meeting between Hayashi and Kim is aimed at stabilizing the bilateral relationship at a time when mutual suspicion has been growing, said Kyoko Hatakeyama, a professor at the University of Niigata Prefecture in Japan. Quote, Japan hopes to maintain a good relationship with China, particularly when Beijing has strengthened its relationship with Russia, she noted. Tokyo hopes that strengthening relationship with China can be an incentive for Beijing to be a responsible power, quote unquote. With regard to the ongoing war in Ukraine, Hayashi called on China to play a responsible role in guaranteeing global peace and security. On a visit to Moscow last month, Chinese President Xi Jinping called Russian President Vladimir Putin his, quote, dear friend, end quote, and further consolidated their, quote, no limits partnership, end quote. Within their territorial dispute and chip technology restrictions, Tokyo is also concerned about increased Chinese military collaboration with Russia and activities in the East China Sea, including the repeated entry of Chinese Coast Guard vessels into disputed waters near the cluster of uninhabited islands known as the Senkaku in Japan and Diaoyu in China. While currently under Japanese administration, Beijing has claimed ownership of the disputed islands. Meanwhile, Japan's decision to dramatically increase its defense budget and strengthen cooperation with allies like the United States have caused China to question Tokyo's intentions. After Japan announced its decision to restrict the export of semiconductor manufacturing equipment on Friday, Qin urged Tokyo not to join U.S. efforts to contain China's development. Quote, the United States used bullying tactics to brutally suppress the Japanese semiconductor industry, and now it is repeating its old tricks against China, end quote, Qin told his counterpart. He also accused Japan of being Washington's minion, quote, end quote. Hayashi underlined that the restrictions were, quote, consistent with international rules, end quote, adding that they were, quote, not aimed at a specific country, end quote. The curbs are in line with similar measures from the United States and the Netherlands aimed at restricting China's ability to make advanced processor chips. Striking a balance between China and the United States, while geopolitical tensions with Beijing have forced Tokyo to deepen its scrutiny of security cooperation with the United States and other like-minded allies, economic ties between Japan and China remain robust, with bilateral trade exceeding $370 billion in 2021. Hatakayama, from the University of Niigata Prefecture, advised Deutsche Welle that it's difficult for Tokyo to determine whether it should prioritize economic ties with Beijing or deepen security cooperation with Washington. Quote, even though Japan wouldn't align itself with the United States completely, when asked to choose between the economy and national security, I think Japan will have to prioritize the latter, she said. Stephen Nagy, a political and a scientist at the International Christian University in Japan, said that by using a formula of, quote, engagement, resilience, and deterrence, end quote, Japan is attempting to maintain meaningful exchange with China through economic partnership and cooperation in areas like environmental issues, while initiating the process to diversify its supply chain away from the Chinese market. While there are tensions over Taiwan, tensions have also been rising between China and Japan over Taiwan. Beijing has claimed the island as its territory and vowed to reunify with the mainland by force if necessary. On Sunday, Hayashi said he spoke to Qin about the importance of ensuring peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. Beijing said that Qin warned Japan, quote, not to interfere in the Taiwan issue or undermine China's sovereignty in any form, quote, end quote, assessing that Taiwan is, quote, at the core of China's core interests, end quote. Yu Hua Chen, a China expert in Akita International University, said that China won't reduce its military or diplomatic pressure on Taiwan, and it also won't reduce the number of military activities around the island. Quote, in the coming years, China will push Taiwan much harder, and Japan will probably try to offer Taiwan more support too, he said. Nagy pointed out that Tokyo is joining forces with other democratic partners to deter Beijing from trying to use force to take Taiwan or the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. Quote, they are working through arrangements like Quad to ensure that China can't fundamentally rewrite the regional security architecture, end quote, referring to the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, a U.S.-led security alliance. Unbelievable what goes on, huh? So much on the world stage. Let me just look here. I think you'll find this interesting. After Iran yogurt attack, Raisi says that the hijab is mandated by law. Iran has ordered the arrest of two women allegedly attacked for flouting head carving rules. This comes after an incensed man poured yogurt over their heads in a shop in the northeast of the country. Closed caption TV footage of the incident has gone viral. So that is unbelievable what's going on. I think you'll find this really fascinating. There are four ways artificial intelligence will reshape society. So artificial intelligence systems such as ChatGPT are dominating headlines. There are concerns that their rise may lead to the displacement of millions of workers, blur the distinction between truth and falsehood, and amplify existing inequalities. And are these worries justified? Yes, because, you know, whereas, for example, when you look at comments that are made on, on the internet, for example, there are people who can challenge comments that are made, and there are that do. And then there's also, those are comments, and so a comment can go either way. But then you've got items that are, that the internet is a source of information, but not all the information is true or correct, but there is no corrective action taken by any particular operation that's on the internet that will check its facts or change the facts once they recognize that there is an issue. So there is no delving into it. So when you engage artificial intelligence, you're engaging the internet because that's where all those sources come from. So it's all pulled together and presented as a finished product with the artificial intelligence based on the question asked of it. But some of it may be incorrect, even though there may have been corrections elsewhere, but not necessarily on the internet. So people are not going to know what's right and what's wrong and can't make a judgment call. And that becomes a problem because there is no oversight. And that becomes a real issue. Luckily, because I was thinking about this, and I spoke with my webmaster about this yesterday. While we were talking, it dawned on me that when one writes on the national or the international stage, then there are so many aspects that are not known by those who research the information. Because that research will come out of the internet. It will be deduced from the internet. And artificial intelligence will put it together. And the reader, including those that espouse it in their own work as a reporter, when it's launched online, they don't know if it's true or not true. They don't know if corrections have been made or ever needed to be made, or if this is all solid fact. Which brings up a really very fascinating situation for me, because I write only about the local scene. I spend most of my focus on the city of Yonkers and other places also beyond Yonkers. But Yonkers, you have to understand, is the third largest city in the state of New York. Yonkers is, though, part of the Westchester County, the county itself. So the county is greater than the city, county, and then the state. And then, of course, the federal government. On the local scene, the Yonkers scene, the Westchester County scene, I delve into that world. And when I go beyond that world, when I go on to the national stage or the international stage, we've got writers, for example, who report from Israel. We have writers from Zurich, Switzerland. We have writers from other places that are familiar with the local community that is being covered. And that is crucial. Because on the local scene, if you maintain your focus on the local scene, wherever that local scene is, then you have an intimate knowledge of what goes on there. And it is more likely to be correct than to be incorrect. And I'm comforted in knowing that as a personal, demeanor, I check my sources over and over and over again. I ask questions of myself. What is the logic of this conduct? What is its intent? What can it cause? And why was it instituted? And who benefits from it? And so on and so forth. You've got to ask all those questions rather than to presume or assume that any particular thing you become familiar with is the reality and can be recognized as real and credible. And that's not always the case. One of the things that was really fascinating for me, and everyone told me I was off the wall, but when the Yonkers mayor ran for a third, fourth-year term, I said it was logical for him, even though he claimed he would not run for a third, four-year term. That's what he said. I said, it's no way he's not going to run for a third, four-year term. Because he wants to take a bow for all that's been accomplished under his watch. And now he's running again for another four-year term. It will be the fourth four-year term. And he is running. And why would he not want to? He wants to because he wants to take a bow and take a bow for all the accomplishments under his watch, under his leadership, under his mayoralty. And there are lots that he can credibly state are his accomplishments. City's in a better state. We've got a casino that's opening up, full-fledged casino, bringing unbelievable amount of funding to the city, balance the books on education, and so on and so forth. Everywhere you look, something has been happening. There's talk about building a university or a college campus in Yonkers. We don't have one. We're the third largest city. You would think that we would, but then again, we're surrounded by New York City to our south, Westchester County, other universities in Westchester County as well. So we're probably going to be the last one around, but it doesn't matter. The point is it's something that he anticipates building. There's also more development in the city, more investors in the city, more housing in the city. It's building and building and building, however you look at it. And that's something to be, admired. And if not admired, certainly respected. Because no other government in Yonkers has been able to do as much as this particular administration. Does that or should that afford the mayor an opportunity to run for a fourth four-year term? Well, he got approval from the city council. Was their conduct appropriate? I don't necessarily think so, because they are conflicted, because they voted for the mayor having another four-year term, which will also permit them to also have another additional term. So are they voting for the mayor, or are they voting for themselves? And who's voting for what's best for the people? I don't know. And that's the question. There are lawsuits against this ever coming about. I don't know if it's going to be proven that this running for a fourth four-year term is credible or will be permitted. I don't know. But we'll have to see. These are some of the issues that come into play. But the beauty of it is that because I'm on such a personal level with everyone, even those that don't care to share thinking with me or to advise me what is or is not going on or are challenging even my concern or my interest by not responding, there are enough people in the city of Yonkers that one I can go to that I know and they know me and who trust me and have a reason to trust me, and they know that whatever they share with me is just between, is mano a mano, or a woman to mano, with the bottom line is it's all very personal. It's one-on-one. It goes nowhere. Nobody gets anything that from me. So the people that I speak to always know that they never hear anything that I said this, that, or another about them, whoever them are. And that's my lifeline. My only credibility, my passport in Yonkers is my silence about all the information that I have. And the information I have is not from one source, but from many sources. There's no need to actually name those sources unless they want to be named. But there's no reason for it, because I have created my bona fides are who I am, what I am, what I've produced. I've got a legacy of 25 years online, and it's still there. As long as I live, that repertoire of work will be there, and even beyond my death, my demise, for quite a few years. But the bottom line is, it's there. And it has not, and nothing has been expunged. So that's important. Well, looks like we've only got seconds left, so I want to wish you all a great day. It's Tuesday. Tomorrow is another day. And I'm really not quite sure. I have to look at my schedule and see who we've got scheduled for tomorrow. But if we don't have I think we may not have anyone scheduled from 10 to 10:30. So if that's the case, I'll be sending a call to Jeff and hopefully he'll be able to attend tomorrow's show after whatever transpired at the courtroom in downtown Manhattan with respect to the former president. So take care and be well. Thanks for being with us. Always a pleasure. Goodbye.